You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Alex.
Hey, Bob. How are you?
I'm doing great. Let me introduce us. That's an inside joke, folks. So I'm Robert Wright. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. I publish a Non-Zero newsletter. Everyone should subscribe to it. You're Alex Gibney, as you know, famous documentary maker. You won the Academy Award for Best Documentary in 2007 for Taxi to the Dark Side. You've done a number of other documentaries of note. For example, before that, you did Enron, The Smartest Guys in the Room in 2005. Now, Alex, you probably don't remember this because so many of my contributions to American culture are forgotten, but the night you had to finalize the title for the Enron documentary, you called me for guidance.
Did I?
Yes. And such was your trust in me before you knew me better.
You try to talk me out of it, or did you agree it was a good title?
The question was, you were thinking about just calling it The Smartest Guys in the Room, but there was an argument for having the word Enron in there somewhere. I think I argued for that. I don't really remember how it came out, but I think I did want the word Enron in there somewhere. Anyway, you managed to have it both ways. It did great. And, you know, then you went on to win the Academy Award. And who knows, if the Enron thing hadn't had a good title, if you hadn't consulted me, would you have won the Academy Award for the other documentary?
It wasn't until this moment that I realized it.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, you sure didn't remember why you were giving the Academy Award acceptance speech, because I know you didn't thank me.
That's true.
For working on the title of your previous
film. Yeah.
But yeah. By the way, what's it like? You didn't seem intimidated at all when you gave that speech. I would have been like visibly sweating.
I was sweating. I mean, it is a very nervous making experience, because as soon as you get up there, this massive clock is in front of you counting down the seconds. Mm. I had kind of thought about what I was going to say, and sort of figured that they weren't going to give Best Documentary Filmmaker a lot of extra time. So I did have something, you know, on my mind, but I think I did okay. I think I did pretty well with the speech, but it was intensely nervous making. It helped that I had been there once before as a nominee and hadn't won.
Was that for Enron?
It was for Enron. We were nominated.
Well, there you go. You're welcome. Go ahead.
And it was when I arrived for Enron, I was much more actually arrogant. And I remember walking onto the red carpet and some photographer beckoned me over. And I said, of course, he's calling me over. I directed Enron, The Smartest Guys in the Room. I came over to the photographer. He said, would you get the fuck out of the way? Jennifer Aniston is coming. So it helped to have a sense of humility when I went.
Brought you down to earth.
Because Taxi to the Dark Side, I think we broke everybody's Oscar pool. No, I don't think anybody expected us to win.
Is that right? You hadn't heard from insiders that you had a good shot?
No. And, you know, it was a dark movie.
It was about a guy basically that we kind of, tortured to death in Afghanistan?
He tortured to death a complete innocent, a taxi driver, an Afghan taxi driver named Dilawar, who we literally tortured to death in the Bagram prison.
Huh. And it was a great documentary. Very sad story.
Very sad story. It sort of used to look at a larger system of torture that we had enabled and engendered and legalized.
And we're here to talk about another sad story. So,
yeah, really sad.
I just watched the BB Files, which you're not the director of, you're a producer of, and it is a product of Jigsaw Productions, which you run.
Yep.
And, you and I talked about it a little bit. It's great. I recommend it to everyone. It's about Bibi Netanyahu's corruption case and the connection of that to the Gaza war and a lot of stuff. And then there's kind of a backstory about some challenges, let's just say, you had getting it distributed by virtue of the politics associated with this issue.
Yep.
And we will be getting into that. But for starters, why don't, well, first of all, there's a big, there's something that, a big asset that kind of makes the whole thing, which is somehow you guys got a hold of the kind of the tapes of the interrogation as the prosecutor was, I guess, deciding whether to indict Netanyahu, which ultimately happened. The interrogation of him and of a bunch of people, how do you, I, can you not say how exactly?
I can say how I got it. I can't say who gave it to me. I mean, I got a message on Signal one day saying, from my source, saying that the source had this material. It was going to be really great, and it was going to blow the lid off. And it won't surprise you to learn that I get a lot of these messages, and sometimes they're bullshit, but sometimes they're real. This one turned out to be real. And then when I asked to see a sample and I saw it, I thought, oh, my God. And this was, prior, by the way, prior to October 7th or the Gaza War. This was, you know, when Israel was sort of erupting in demonstrations over Netanyahu's attempts to take control of the judiciary, or to put the, you know, sort of not take control, but to weaken the judiciary. And, but, you know, a lot of what I do is to deal with corruption, and this was corruption of the highest order. And suddenly I was handed 1,000 hours of police interrogation videos of Netanyahu, his wife, Sarah, his son, Yair, and a whole bunch of other people, including a famous Hollywood film producer named Arnon Milchan, Sheldon Adelson, all sorts of people who were swept up in the web of corruption. And so we had this material, and then I set out to find a director, a woman I'd worked with before named Alexis Bloom. She had produced the film I did on Julian Assange, and also had directed a film that I produced about Roger Ailes. She was perfect. You know, she'd been to Israel many times, and she took it on board, and we made the film. And ultimately, over time, October 7th happened, the Gaza War happened, and the material became both about his personal corruption, which was evident, but also how his attempts to elude any reckoning for that corruption led to him embracing the foulest figures that I guess were just sanctioned, Ben-Gavir and Smotrich, you know.
Yeah, as we tape this, this may not run for a week or two even, but as we tape this, these two members of his cabinet were sanctioned by Canada, Britain, and several other nations, which is a first. And they are, they're just the worst of the worst. I mean, one of them had, until it became politically inconvenient a couple of years ago, had on his wall a picture of, is it, it's Baruch Goldstein, I think, the guy who went into a mosque at the Tomb of the Patriarchs in Hebron and with a submachine gun and killed like 20 Palestinians or something. I mean, he had this guy's picture up on his wall.
Yeah.
They're bad. They, so yeah, go ahead. Sorry, go ahead with the story. So that, and what was the, and what are the consequences of that for the Gaza War?
Well, I think the idea was that Netanyahu, in trying to elude a reckoning, both tried to, he tried to stay in power. Because what's the best way not to be prosecuted for cheap corruption? You stay in power. And then, so he forms this cabinet. He attempts to undermine the judiciary. You could argue, as we suggest, as many of the people in the film suggest, you know, that he actually helped precipitate the attack on October 7th by coddling Hamas in order to outflank the Palestinian Authority, coddling and funding Hamas. And then to carry on a massive war with no end, a permanent war, is the best way to say, I can't be bothered with these petty corruption issues. I've got a war to run. But what, I mean, talk about corruption. There is the corruption in terms of taking sort of elemental bribes. So what is the corruption of a man who's willing to kill 50 to 100,000 people in order to elude a reckoning for his misdeeds? So it's a pretty, yeah, it's a staggering story of corruption of at the absolute highest, or I guess you could say lowest level.
Yeah, and apparently every once in a while when he starts flirting with the idea, I guess under pressure from somebody, of actually bringing the thing to an end. The reports are that these two guys who he brought into his cabinet as a result of this scandal say to him, no, if you stop the war, we're out. And then he would lose power.
Right.
And then he could face trial and go to court. As the documentary explains, in the past, any prime minister who's indicted would resign. But he said, no, I'm not doing that. The parties to the left said, well, then we're having nothing to do with you. Not far left, but the members of his coalition to his left said that. And as a result, he wound up with these two guys.
Yeah,
I don't know how far they are from his actual ideology anyway, but go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I should say he's actually on trial. The trial's been ongoing.
Oh, really?
4 or 5 years. Yeah. And he just keeps stringing it out. So the trial has begun.
So
this is a trial.
But being prime minister helps him string it out.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And particularly being a wartime prime minister helps string it out.
Okay. So let's talk about the scandal itself, which is fascinating. I mean, it really is riveting to just to have all of the participants tell their story in that situation where they don't imagine being, on my TV screen. They're being interrogated. Some of them are shockingly candid. I mean, one striking thing is that usually when there's a bribery case, people on both sides of the bribe deny or minimize it, right? It's like BB keeps saying, these were just gifts from friends. So you would expect the people who gave them to him to say, yeah, it was just a gift for me. But a couple of them are saying, no, they demanded this stuff.
Yes.
We were meeting demands.
In particular, Arnon Milchan. It was a demand. And one of the interviews that Alexis got was with Arnon Milchan's assistant, Hadas Klein, and more than assistant, kind of a chief of staff for Arnon
Milchan.
She's
great.
And these were demands. And it's like, if you want, I must have this. And of course, Arnon Milchan needed things from him. He needed a visa. And so Netanyahu gets on the phone to John Kerry. And this was we started with a sort of a seamier but smaller bribes, which were, pink champagne for Sarah and Cubans, $100 Cuban cigars for Netanyahu plus
Sarah is his wife, is Bibi's wife.
That's right. And that amounted to about $250,000. So it was not, there's a lot of cigar, champagne, and jewelry. But then he was also trading favors with media owners. So he was essentially trading regulatory relief for favorable coverage in the media.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's another case that we dealt with. But yeah, I think one of the things that was interesting to me about this was that Netanyahu is such a good, I hesitate to use the word good with Netanyahu, but is such a skilled and stage-managed public speaker. And he rarely lets himself be caught in unrehearsed unrehearsed situations. But here he was talking to people, and he's still performing, but he's performing to an audience, as you say, who he thinks is just going to be there for, I mean, this is stuff that is usually not shown in court unless you're impeaching testimony. So he's just thinking like, I'm with my peeps here, and so I'm going to let my hair down. But also he gets insulted. He clearly lies over and over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And the cops are laughing at him because he's lying so brazenly. But maybe the most astounding interview is with Sarah Netanyahu, his wife, who is just the sort of comical Lady Macbeth of this story, who's slapping her hand on the, how dare you even ask questions of me, as if she is, prime minister.
She's quite a handful. I imagine he has moments of wondering whether she was the optimal choice of spouse. I mean, people testify that she's just very mercurial. She drinks a lot, apparently. And one question was, so first of all, I'm surprised to hear you say that it only added up to about $250,000, because I was thinking, I mean, first of all, there's a ton of $100 bottles of champagne and cigars, but I was thinking there was a single piece of jewelry, a bracelet that they gave her that I thought was like worth, it was either worth $140,000 or $240,000.
Oh, no, I don't think so. I think it was more like $40,000. In other words, it was
I bet it was $140,000. I'm going with $142,000.
Okay, you check. And I encourage all you people out there listening to rent the film and check yourselves.
Definitely. This is a good motivation. I think the bracelet was returned because Bibi said to Sarah, no, that's too gaudy. It had like a zillion diamonds. And so she went back and says, Bibi says people would ask where I got this. So could you tone it down a little? So maybe in the end, the value was less, and then there's the champagne. Now, Sarah drank all that champagne. Is that the idea? They didn't like resell it.
She drank it, and he smoked them. So
he smoked the cigars.
Yeah,
which are like $1,000 a box or something. Apparently,
yeah, they're $100 a cigar.
Yeah. So it adds up, and as you say, there's a kind of a separate quid pro quo involving this media organization, which was very influential, although most Americans apparently, I'm sure, haven't heard of it, which had traditionally been, I guess, kind of to his left. At least he depicted it that way. And so what exactly happened there?
So it was a kind of a trade of regulatory relief, which was worth a considerable amount of money. That was hundreds of millions for favorable coverage on this website called Walla. And because Bibi's obsessed with his image. In fact, you know, it was good publicity for us, but when we premiered this film, we premiered the film as a work in progress because we were desperate to get it noticed in order to attract enough attention so that we could get it distributed. We premiered it as a work in progress at the Toronto Film Festival. As soon as it was announced, Netanyahu went to court in Israel to try.
Excellent.
It couldn't have been better.
Streisand effect. Thank you.
Hello. Yes. But that's how he can't help himself when it comes to managing his appearance.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, that has a kind of a parallel to what's going on with Trump and CBS. So Paramount, which owns CBS, they want favorable regulatory decision that will let them buy somebody or merge with somebody or something. So they, first of all, they're offering to settle this suit that Trump filed against CBS, which he would almost surely lose.
Right.
They've offered, last I heard, they had offered $10 million, Paramount. Here's $10 million, which I think nominally would go to something other than Trump, his library or something, you know, like the jet, like the 747 he got picked up in the Middle East. But also they have pressured CBS to lighten up on him. Two very highly placed, prominent CBS journalists have resigned over it. I think the producer of 60 Minutes or something. You know, it's very much, it's the same thing. I mean, I guess it's not illegal in America because it's fundamentally the same thing. I guess technically that $10 million is not going into Trump's pockets, but there are parallels.
There are definitely parallels. And I think, you know, part of the whole film, you know, one of the goals of the film was to sort of, in addition to showing the venal corruption of this man and how it led to the carnage in Gaza, it was also to show this is the authoritarian playbook. This is how you put it together. This is what you do. You know, step one, put together some right-wing coalition. Step two, try to defang the judiciary. And in Trump's case, make the Department of Justice and the FBI a kind of mob enforcement mechanism. Also the whole idea of freely trading favors for coverage. It's very Trumpian, very Bibi, very Orban, you know, it's a playbook.
And by the way, there's one case where money is getting put directly into to Trump's pockets. And you may have something to say about this since it involves a documentary. So Amazon Video is paying Melania, what, $25 million to do a documentary about her? Is that the...
Brett Ratner was given a contract, I believe, of $40 million to do a documentary about Melania Trump. And of that $40 million budget, I believe the line item for Melania, maybe it's for hair and makeup, is $25
million. Well, you got to look nice. You want to look nice for a documentary.
You do. You do. And that should help.
Yeah. She'll be in a good mood, you know. It helps to be smiling.
Yeah, in a good mood. Yeah, that was the most craven kind of, I mean, what our powerful business leaders have shown the most, you know, the most rubbery knees you could possibly imagine when it comes to.
And Jeff Bezos, of course, who owns Amazon, has a ton of business in front of the government, notably his space business. I mean, I'm sure there are cases where Amazon would like some kind of favorable deal with the government every once in a while. But the space thing, which is very much in flux now that people are raising questions about whether Elon Musk is somebody you can rely on, since after the Trump spat, he threatened to decommission these rockets that the government depends on. So suddenly questions are being asked about that. And I would think Bezos is sitting all that much prettier by virtue of having deposited $25 million in the Trump family coffers.
Yeah. No, it's the grossest kind of crony capitalism, and that's what we've come to. As the state and its power in some ways is kind of withered, you have these big business leaders who just find these transactional leaders and just paying them off. Mm-hmm. They find that more effective than investing in democracy.
Yeah. So I want to talk about the issues you had trying to get it distributed. Is there anything else you want to say about the documentary itself? I mean, it really is, you'll have no trouble focusing on it. It's really riveting. But Gaza doesn't come up very explicitly until the end. There is footage of both October 7th and then of Gaza.
Yep.
And again, the war might well have been wrapped up quite a bit sooner if Netanyahu hadn't faced this corruption issue. But is there anything else you want to say about the making of documentary or documentary?
No, I don't think so. I mean, the only thing I should say, since it may come up, it's a technical issue, but since it may come up as we discuss how difficult it was to get it distributed, one agreement I had to make with the source was not to distribute the film in Israel, because there's a law in Israel. It's a privacy law that says that if you're photographed as part of an official proceeding, that material can't be publicly shown without the permission of the subject. And it won't surprise you to learn that Benjamin Netanyahu did not give his permission. So so we had to agree. That was the only condition on the use of the material, was that I not allow it to be officially distributed in Israel. Now, since that time, of course, it's been wildly pirated, as nobody is more skilled at internet piracy than Israelis. So so many, 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 many Israelis have seen it.
I would direct people to your documentary, Zero Days.
Yes.
If they'd like to know about Israeli technical skills. That's the one about Stuxnet, right?
That's right. That's right.
That's great. That's worth watching. And you wound up knowing who the source is, I assume.
I know who the source is, but I'm not telling.
No, I wouldn't think. But I was wondering if these days it's possible for them to maintain their anonymity while communicating with you. Some people might say you should find out who it is before you accept the stuff. I personally wouldn't. I mean, the sources always have ulterior motives. I mean, they have a reason they're giving it to you. And this weird convention has developed in American journalism. I like to think it's subsiding. It showed up about 20 years ago where they report that, you know, the source who chose to remain anonymous because of X. And then, first of all, they always just take the source's word for it, and half the time it's bullshit. But secondly, I mean, like, who cares? I mean, the material is the material. and you've got it. We know the source had some reason, and it probably wasn't pure. But
yeah, sometimes it's useful to know why it's being leaked, because it may give you a clue as to whether or not it's authentic, and you may want to check that, which is always good to do. But yeah, I mean, you know, the original conceit, though I don't think it was the most important thing about, you know, his original deal, but the original conceit of WikiLeaks was that you would have an anonymous Dropbox, right? And then you would just drop materials in the Dropbox, and then somebody like Julian Assange would then publish it. And that way, that would be good source protection. It didn't work out that way for Charles Manning, but that's another story.
I'm getting mixed up between Chelsea Manning and Reality Winner. Did you see this play called Is This a Room in New York?
Is that about Reality Winner?
I think so. She went to jail, right?
Yeah.
It's completely great. What they did, it is an exact reading of the recorded interaction between her and the, I think, FBI agents who descended on her house and slowly got her to confess. It's an amazing piece of work. It's nonfiction, in effect, in the theater. So about the distribution issues, tell us about your troubles. By the way, first, where can people go to stream it? It's on Vimeo. Is it other places?
It's not on Vimeo. Right now it's on a website called jolt.film. So if you go to jolt.film, just dial it up, just like it's spelled, JOLT.film. You know, they ask you to register and then you can sign up to watch it. I think within a week or two, it should also be on Amazon Prime and an Apple, you know, for pay-per-view. But it never was able to get, which we'll discuss. It was never able. That's in this country. By the way, it's being distributed in more conventional terms overseas. But in this country, that's the way to see it. And no streamer, it's shocking to learn, you know, step forward to distribute. I think that 5 years ago, there would have been a bidding war. But now there's just such an aversion for controversy in general, and particularly on this issue. Nobody wants to touch it. And we can get into some specifics.
I find that odd because, first of all, American sentiment has shifted toward being more critical of Israel over the last few years, especially over the last year. And it's dramatic. I mean, you look at the polling numbers. And secondly, it's like, in a certain sense, if I'm Israel or if I'm an Israeli citizen, especially of a certain ideological persuasion, I'd be going like, look, you don't understand. This isn't this. Me and my friends don't support continuing the war. This is just Bibi. And that's very much what you see in the documentary, is that because of some forces bearing on Bibi and the way he reacted to them, the war goes on and on, and it wouldn't necessarily go on if it were in some sense merely an expression of Israel's character, right? I mean, that could be one of your takeaways. And I would think that's almost as good as you can do for Israeli PR at this point, is to say it's this one guy. And so the other reason I'm surprised is, you don't dwell on the Gaza footage. You show the October 7th stuff. You show the Gaza stuff. It's not, as Gaza footage goes, it's not egregiously gory. So I'm genuinely kind of surprised, but you seem not to be.
We know that there's tremendous audience interest in it. The problem is the gatekeepers. And this has been coming for some time. Are shying away more and more and more for anything that's controversial. And part of that is for business reasons.
About Israel, you mean?
Well, part of it is, I was going to say, is for business reasons. In other words, you know, if you're selling iPhones, you don't want to make anybody unhappy. So, but and or if you're about to, you know, move into a more commercial driven universe like Netflix is, you don't want to upset advertisers. You know, this is getting back to the way things used to be in the horrible 90s. But I also think that on this issue, nobody wants the hassle of AIPAC coming down on your ass. Nobody wants the hassle of, you know, people screaming in your ear and being accused of being anti-Semitic. It's honestly reprehensible because it prevents any kind of decent debate from happening. You know, I'll give you an example. And this is more of a tawdry reason than anything principled. But, you know, going into, we were self-financed. So a bunch of investors plus people who gave us grants allowed us to make the movie. So we don't have a distributor. We're going into Toronto to try to get one, and we wanted to try to drum up publicity. And NBC News became interested in the story because, of course, we had this footage that nobody had ever seen, this corruption footage of Netanyahu's on trial. And we had a story all set to go. I believe that the correspondent, Andrea Mitchell, was ready to do the piece. Then the higher-ups at NBC decided that, you know what, this is going to be awkward for us. I mean, Netanyahu will be angry at us. And that way we won't get that much access. And also it's not really our scoop, so we won't get that much credit for us. So all in all, it's just going to be a hassle for us. So we're not going to do the story. So for all sorts of bad reasons, good journalism doesn't happen. And I think that, you know,
and can I just add that the idea that because it's not their story, that's disqualifying is like bullshit, right? They do this all the time. It's like draw on somebody else's reporting to do a good feature.
That's right. And then, you know, hopefully you cite that person's reporting. You know, it's like, but they didn't want to take the hit or the heat from Netanyahu in Israel, you know, in terms of their access to him and the perceptions of being fair or anti-Semitic, you know, if it wasn't their story. So, yeah, it was the most venal and petty reason for not doing a good and important story. In the case of BBC, you know, we were told that they were happy to show the film, provided we took out anything relating to Gaza. So, I'm so flummoxed by this, where, you know, you would hope that networks would see it in their interest to air programs that engage in controversial subjects so that people can weigh in and talk about them. And as you say, this film, I mean, every voice in the film is basically an Israeli voice. And there are many who are critical of Netanyahu. But it's what they're saying is this guy has hijacked, you know, Israeli democracy, and he's running a war in order to elude punishment for, you know, corruption. Mm-hmm. Right. And this, by the way, is something that is on the pages of Haaretz every day.
It's a very common view in Israel.
Yeah. But it can't be aired here somehow, you know, or you're anti-Semitic. And it was interesting, you know, when we would have Q&As, I noted, you know, when we would go to various theaters, there would always be a plant. I presume it's from AIPAC or related group, you know, in the audience that would ask the exact same question every time. You know, it's like, you said at the end that there were, I think we said 40,000 dead in Gaza, but you didn't distinguish between the civilians and the Hamas fighters, you know.
Well, you're not the only one who doesn't make that distinction, but I won't. What I'm referring to, I mean, I don't want to be snide. I think Israel's targeting criteria. There was a good piece in 972, this Israeli magazine, about how they use AI to do targeting. And And I think one effect of that is to wind up, you know, when you see a fighting age Palestinian male, to err on the side of the assumption that it's Hamas. And so I think they could be, I think the targeting criteria could be more fastidious.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, you know,
leave aside the just like, yeah, well, okay, if we can kill one important guy, knowing we'll probably kill 100 civilians, we'll do it, leaving aside that whole issue.
Right. There's the whole issue of the Geneva Conventions and all of that, international law, you know, proportionality, intentional targeting of civilians, you know, all that. And also, you know, Mossad, who is or Shin Bet, depending on who's involved, probably have a pretty sophisticated understanding of Hamas. And they probably have a pretty sophisticated understanding that Hamas spends most of their time when they don't want to get killed in this warren of tunnels. And so what's the best way to kill somebody who's deep down in a tunnel? Would that be to turn a hospital or an apartment building into rubble and kill all the women and children in that apartment building?
That is actually what they say the answer is, yeah. I mean, what they say recently, they say that Sinwar, the second Sinwar that they killed, they say he was in a tunnel under a hospital or something, yeah. And that's why they blew up the hospital. But apparently you're saying that now Amazon and Apple will ultimately offer it on streaming or what?
They'll offer it as pay-per-view. In other words, you can go to their service and say, here's $3 for a rental, or here's $10 for a purchase.
So if you're already a paid subscriber to them, you still have to pay extra?
Yeah, I mean, it's usually offered as a pay deal. You know, Amazon for Prime does offer certain films for Prime members, you know, for free. But generally speaking, when you go on Amazon and Apple have become kind of the warehouses for films. So when you want to see that film that you can't, that isn't currently streaming, you go there and you pay a fee, which is what you do on Jolt. I mean, you know, that's the idea there too. And Jolt was an interesting idea. Initially, they have a series of algorithms not to control the making of programs, but to kind of find viewers. And they use a lot of social media and also influencers to try to find viewers. But not enough people had really heard of Jolt.film as this conversation references. What was interesting though about the process with Jolt was that we discovered that many of our ads weren't being run by Meta. You know, they refused to run our ads.
Really?
Yeah, because of our political content.
Wow. So there were a number of distributors who in the past with a documentary of this caliber, you wouldn't have had much trouble getting them to be avenues of distribution. And this time around, it wasn't the case.
Correct. But for, like I said, for reasons stated, one is I think there's a commercial aversion to controversy. And two, on this subject in particular, people are like, we don't want to feel the heat.
How are they handling that documentary that won the Academy Award, I guess, not long ago, done by an Israeli and a Palestinian?
Yeah, No Other Land is the one you're talking about. And that was interesting. You know, I there was a very enterprising guy named Michael Tuckman who basically went out and sold it theater by theater. It had a kind of theatrical release, and it did rather well. In fact, I was interested that my local theater here in Maine, in Damariscotta, I looked up on the marquee, No Other Land. So, you know, it was penetrating both theaters in New York City and smaller theaters in Damariscotta. And I think it's grossed over $2 million. So it's a success from a theatrical perspective. It doesn't reach the kind of people that it would on a streaming platform. But And that's an interesting, you know, there's a period now for filmmakers like me, we're looking for alternative distribution strategies because there are a lot of good films out there that aren't being platformed on the big streamers. And theatrical is one component which can be utilized and was very effectively utilized in this instance. And I remember back in the day, like this was the same problem. Like I did a film with Eugene Jarecki back in the late 90s, maybe it was around 2000, called The Trials of Henry Kissinger. It was a very critical book at Henry Kissinger, which every network in America found off-putting because you can't be critical of Henry Kissinger. And so, but we found an enterprising distributor. In that case, the BBC was responsible for that film and put it on and showed down Henry Kissinger. They said, you know, you have right to reply, but we're showing this movie. And he tried to get him to take it off. But in this country, it was a small enterprising theatrical distributor that got an engagement with the Film Forum and played there for 4 months and then played around the country. And then ultimately that allowed it to be entertainment. And then when it was entertainment, then it could go on a network. And in that case, so Sundance Channel.
Did you try to get theatrical release with this one?
We did. We did. And, you know, it did show in a few theaters. It did very well, actually, at the IFC Cinema in New York. Not so well in a theater in L.A. But we did also approach a number of theatrical distributors to take it out for us. And a number of them declined because they were just either afraid or burned out of this particular subject. It's not easy out there.
No, and we're going to talk about that more, how not easy it is for documentaries generally. But first, I want to say that, as you know, these podcasts are divided into two parts. First part is for the public. Then we go into overtime, which is available to paid subscribers to the Non-Zero newsletter. Anybody can become one. I encourage them to by going to, well, Non-Zero or clicking the link in the show notes. And thereafter, you can set up a magic podcast feed that always has the overtime segments. And Alex, you've been kind enough to stick around. Before we go, we're going to talk about a lot of stuff in overtime. I said, you know, documentary business is getting tough. There was a story in the New York Times not that long ago about you selling a share of Jigsaw to Wendy Schmidt, wife of Eric Schmidt of Google, former Google CEO, partly in reflection of how challenging things are for documentaries, as I think you were quoted as saying in the New York Times. I want to talk about that. I want to talk a little about some new stuff you've got coming out. I want to reminisce a little about our own never quite fulfilled collaborative effort. I still have footage, Alex, from our little journey across.
I still remember some of the interviews that we did. I was thinking about, was it William Hamilton?
Yeah, the late, great William Hamilton. Several people who are no longer alive that we have footage of who were very important figures in evolutionary biology or evolutionary psychology, including Robert him and Trivers, George Williams.
I recall we going out
Trivers
to...
Trivers still alive, but we have Trivers. Richard Alexander's no longer alive. Margot Wilson is no longer alive. I keep meaning to do something with that. But anyway, before we go, tell us what you want people to know about stuff you're doing now. You had this Dark Money two-episode series. I heard you talking about it on Chris Hedges' podcast. That was a great conversation. And then you've got something coming up on Showtime, I think, before long. Is that right? In the fall or show something?
No. I mean, there's some films that I've produced. I mean, obviously, there's a company that I have that I am president of, and we do a lot of stuff that I produce that I don't direct. There was a film that just came out in Tribeca called Bodyguard of Lies, which piggybacks on the Washington Post investigation where they got all the IG materials of the war in Afghanistan, where everybody was every step along the way was telling the IG how bad things were going as our leaders were telling us how good they were, how good it was going. That just premiered. That'll be on Paramount Plus. But the two films I'm working on at the moment are, oh, and I just produced a film called Orwell, 2 + 2 = 5, about George Orwell. It's directed by Raoul Peck, the guy who did I'm Not Your Negro. And it just premiered at Cannes. And that'll be premiering, I think, in theaters this fall. It's powerful because it's about, it sort of takes the story of Orwell writing 1984 and then goes backwards into his life, but also flicks forward into today. It's good. And then I'm working on a film on Elon Musk. I have been for 2 years.
Oh, yeah. Oh, we'll talk about Elon a little in overtime. That'll
and I'm also finishing a film on Salman Rushdie.
Oh, okay. So there's a lot to talk about. I hope people join us in overtime. In any event, thanks for staying with us this long.